Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My two guests today are co-authors of a book about California's prison system and vocational education reform. Tony Waters is a professor of sociology at California State University, Chico, and also on the faculty of peace studies at Paiyap University in Thailand. He has taught criminology, social theory, and cultural theory, among other subjects. He has also written previous books on classical social theory, violence, criminology, and refugees. Tony Waters, welcome.
Thank you very much.
William Rich retired from Chico State, where he taught graduate courses in educational leadership and curriculum in the School of Education. He also served as school district consultant in policy redesign. He has been a private and public school teacher, public school administrator, as well as university professor. Bill Rich, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, I have to admit that I never expected a book about prisons to make me laugh. Especially given the title of your book, Prison Vocational Education and Policy in the United States, A Critical Perspective on Evidence-Based Reform.
Sounds like a real snoozer.
Yeah, I'm afraid it does, Tony.
Very academic.
Yes, and Bill agrees that it's a rather academic title, very emotionless. But when I'm reading your book, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Bill, I'm going to ask you to read what you're calling in your book vignettes. These are stories about your experiences during this period of time when you have been asked to study vocational education in California prisons. And what is the title of this vignette, Bill?
This vignette is entitled, Could the Prisoner Be My Son?
Wow.
Can I talk about this a little bit before we...
Yeah.
Well, so we were hired to go look at these classrooms and evaluate these programs. And yet when we got into these prisons, we were... At least I was. Tony had more experience in prisons, but I was sort of shocked. What kind of a Kafkaesque world am I in? It seemed like around every corner there was a surprise. So this is one of those surprises in this vignette.
Okay, so go ahead. And this is Bill Rich reading from his and Tony's book about prison vocational education.
Could the prisoner be my son? Prisons are far from my life. My wife and I selected a place of immense natural beauty in Northern California to raise our family, with many mountains, streams, and lakes that afford hiking, camping, canoeing, fishing, and skiing, all healthy and active things to do with children. I saw my children in a place of beauty every day. Their small-town schools were inviting and encouraging environments to learn. Their grandparents, aunts, and uncles guided and nurtured them, and their cousins as they played in a small mob they called the Lost Kids, where the youngest stretched to be old enough to join in and the eldest regressed to play the games and tell the make-believe stories. Our children sat in the center of our active lives. As I moved up in my career in education and through leadership roles in various schools, I was principal for each of my children for at least a year. We arranged our work and recreational time in ways to help them grow and thrive at every stage of their development. The fearless and intelligent leadership of my wife constructed an extraordinary family of international, intercultural dimensions I had not dreamed could exist. When our children needed punishment, I applied corporal punishment at the advice of a counselor I respected.
Now, this was interesting, Bill. When you say corporal punishment, we immediately, I thought, oh, no, he doesn't seem like the type that would administer corporal punishment to his son. But I thought, this, what a good idea. Even though you call it corporal punishment, what did you mean by that?
Well, it's the origin of the term corporal punishment, the corpus. You're not punishing the spirit. You don't punish the emotional side of the child. You are punishing the body to a certain extent so that the child will learn and be able to change their behavior, change their decisions. I'll start over in that piece. When our children needed punishment, I applied corporal punishment at the advice of a counselor I respected. This was corporal punishment in the true sense of the term, not simple spanking. Their misdeeds could be worked off in chores that involve physical work that taxed the body. Thus, in a kind of Catholic approach to redemption, weeds were pulled, leaves raked and thrown away, and firewood was moved and restacked in a new place. Afterward, they started over with a clean slate. They knew how to work because I worked with them on projects for fun, like making skim boards for the beach, or on chores like painting around the house. I prayed daily for their protection and happiness. I requested and received a special prayer from our parish worker priest when they learned to drive. Even now, although they are independent adults, I continue to pray for them. When I began to understand the nature of prison during this study, I first focused on the stark incongruities within the social setting, especially the surreal world of Kafka that was so apparent, and the highly controlled, if contradictory, rules of life under the awards and punishment of B.F. Skinner. These associations came to me in conversations with guards, teachers, inmates, and administrators, and were further developed among our research team, Andy and Tony.
Could I interrupt you just a second in case people don't remember what B.F. Skinner advocated?
Okay.
That's the word I'm going
to
use.
I don't know how to be polite about B.F. Skinner.
Well, he was a psychologist.
And basically, B.F. Skinner was the stimulus response person that human beings are really have no original generative existence. They simply respond to their environment. And so they're easily controlled or manipulated. And so there is no what you'd call psycho-spiritual center. Would you agree with that, Tony?
So we
found that in prison. It's a big institution, thousands of inmates, and the idea that management in bigger institutions appreciates is that one gives incentives and disincentives for various behaviors. This is not a nurturing approach. This is a controlling approach. And so we saw that's all over the prison.
And punishment is about what prison's about, is what we talk about in the book. And
Under
the B.F. Skinner type of model, punishment is half of it, and incentives is the other half. And that determines human behavior. So that's what Bill is referring to.
I might remind listeners, this is Professor Tony Waters that is just adding his comment. And retired Professor Bill Rich is reading one of the stories from their book about the prison system and vocational education in the prisons. So you, Bill, you're visiting a prison, and what happens?
So let me interject too as well. So one of the issues here that I mentioned, I felt like I was being slapped in the face a lot with realizations and new understandings.
I think the reader too. When we read your book, I don't know if I would say slapped in the face, but it's, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that. Because for the most part, we don't want to know about prisons. Yeah. We want to go on with our lives. We want the bad people put away in prison, and then we want to forget about it.
Yeah. Exactly. The rest of this passage I want to just sort of frame under the idea that there's academic learning and knowledge, which, of course, I prize. And I think people need to have as much of that as they can possibly stand, because it does really impact your thinking, as we've discussed, and that impacts your life. But there is a difference from sort of the experiential knowing that you get by being in a situation. And so I'm going to carry on with the reading here. So one escapable fact is nearly all the inmates were black or brown men. As visitors,
well, only visited men's prisons.
Correct. Well, we did visit one woman's prison.
Well, unofficially, not part of your study
As visitors, we were the, quote, three white professor guys. We discussed our need to be objective about the things we saw and joked about the way the inmates saw us as aliens from outer space. Who are you? We were asked in every prison. We were not feds, cops, prison administrators, guards, nor teachers. We confused them. Life narratives that came out in interviews with prisoners were equally stark in contrast to our own. How many foster placements are possible above 20? I mean, to interrupt this, we interviewed people with 40 foster placements before they hit 19 and got to prison. How many gang members can you have in your family? These were people, I thought, who lived close to prison in many ways from the early stages of their lives. The scale of racism that worked itself out in the arrest, plea bargains, and incarceration of so many black and brown men was hard to comprehend. I once asked a painting teacher if the students were matched to the class in some way. She told me to, quote, go talk to that guy. I approached a tall Hispanic man who stood staring at a wall. I spoke to him, but he continued to stare. He was incoherent, in a daze. I returned to the painting teacher, who told me he was heavily medicated but had been sent to the class every day for the past 2 years. He spent his time there just wandering around, except when temperatures exceeded 92 degrees. That's when he was sent back to his air-conditioned cell in a special facility designed for the mentally ill, who would otherwise have an adverse reaction with their medication due to the heat. I wondered how living in this environment, overcrowded to the degree of being labeled cruel and unusual by the U.S. Supreme Court, contributed to his condition. The painting teacher used the word, quote, hideous, unquote, to describe the place. High fences and bleak guard towers brooding over the moonscape where no grass is permitted since inmates in such a yard could hide weapons by burying them in the lawn. It's difficult to explain how unusually ugly the environment was to me. I imagined the fine alkali dust that collects on one's clothing as a kind of gray residue that must be exfoliated skin from so many inmates packed together. During exercise period, they walked in circles around a track, and seeing them and thinking of the tall Hispanic man in the vocational painting class, I heard Rilke's verse. Now I want to read this in German. I'll just read the first verse in German.
Well, because that was the language originally written.
Yeah. I'll translate it as well. Sein Blick ist vom Vorübergehen der Stäbe so müd geworden, dass nichts mehr hält. Ihm ist, als ob es tausend Stäbe gäbe und hinter tausend Stäben keine Welt.
So this is what came to your mind when you were thinking of this tall Hispanic man in this vocational painting class.
And watching these men walk around
walk
the track.
Walk around a track.
Yeah.
And so what in English?
So this
because
is
the poem, I think, should be appreciated in its original language, poetry.
Yes. The context is this hideous environment. Here we are from Northern California. We love the nature, outdoors, all these activities. And we're in this deeply, this stark place contained, this fine alkali dust everywhere. And I'll read the translation. His vision from the constantly passing bars has grown so weary that it cannot hold anything else. It seems to him there are 1,000 bars, and behind the bars, no world. And the title of this poem is The Panther. It's about a panther pacing back and forth in a zoo. So I felt that, that wasn't a very research-oriented approach, counting, collecting data, but I was shocked. Again, slapped in the face. I'll continue to read. The next day, we visited an office services class. These students were mainly older Hispanic men. This meant they were serving long terms for anything from murder to molestation. We observed and took notes and afterwards debriefed the teacher. The teacher organized the class so that her porter, that's an institutional job for inmates awarded by custody officials, the porter helped not only in managing the voluminous paperwork, but also in directing the tutorial and other learning support offered by some of the class members to others within the class. She had built a kind of smoothly running learning community here. From the teacher's office, a room at the center of a wing of classrooms, we could see her classroom and another classroom next door through windows in an interior wall. Once we completed the meeting with the office services teacher, I stood up and gazed through the window to the other classroom. It appeared empty. But at the far end, close to the door to the yard, sat two young white men. One had black hair and faced us, and one had sandy hair and had his back to us. Andy entered the room to talk with these young men, and I followed.
Now, we might mention here that there is a third author, and when you mention Andy, this is who is going to this prison with you, and this is deceased Professor Andy Dick. Mm-hmm. You might mention who he is.
I'd love to mention who he is. He's the person who originated this project, who recruited Tony and me, who carried it through immense barriers at the state level and the top of CDCR through the crash of 2008. And I'm happy to say he was a much younger man than I, but a great mentor to me in research and in learning.
At this point in the story, Professor Rich is in a prison and he just sees a couple of inmates, and what then happened?
So we were looking through the window to another classroom. There were a couple of inmates in there. Andy entered the room to talk with these young men, and I followed. As I looked at these inmates, I felt a visceral shock. The man with his back to me moved his arm as he talked, and his movement mimicked my son's way of moving his arm. The back of his head looked like the back of my son's head. He turned his head and back, and it was as if my son were sitting there. I felt my stomach turn and stop breathing for a moment. I moved more quickly to see, absurdly, if my own son were in this prison, if this were some kind of nightmare. Andy introduced us to both the men. I stared intensely at the sandy-haired man, now a boy to me, and more of his movements. The way he held his head, the way he turned his head, mimicked my son's movements. I could barely listen to his story, but calmed myself and paid attention, and I told myself this was not my son. I was not dreaming. But his story continued to align itself in some ways with my own. He was a professor's son from Southern California who loved to surf and play in the outdoors. He had gone astray in his early teens, as many do, according to his own story. Drug use had stunted his emotional development. However, he said he was not punished or corrected in a way that changed him for the better. He continued on a path of self-destructive, nihilistic behavior, focused by petty drug dealing. In the end, the police, prosecutor, and jury believed he ran with an infamous gang and was guilty of accessory to murder. He asserted his friends were not a gang, but a social group, and he had not personally participated in any murder. He felt he suffered a great injustice when at age 20 he was given a sentence of 7 years to life.
You know, this just is so sad. I mentioned all the different emotions, like a roller coaster reading your book, from times laughing at how ridiculous this bureaucracy is, or being, oh my gosh, can that be true? It's so disturbing. And then here is this young man that you think, oh my gosh.
And the reason we think that, and the reason I was so shocked, is because I crossed some line. Before, I was sort of an academic observer. Mm-hmm. Black men, brown men. I certainly don't believe I'm a racist. We're a multi-ethnic family. But I had somehow distanced them from the compassion and shock that I would feel if this were my own family member who was in prison, and the devastating loss that would mean. And when I saw this young man, it kind of all came home to me, what this could really mean in a person's life.
I was once some years ago called in as an interpreter for a couple of, they were kids from my point of view, arrested for smuggling cocaine. They were from Colombia. The lawyers didn't speak Spanish. But these two kids, I mean, one was in medical school. One, his father was a businessman. And I thought, oh, they're just like my college students. And my heart went out to them because they were scared to death. And I can just imagine how you see this young man who looks like your very own son.
Yeah, it was shocking, yeah. So he went on to share, when he first got to prison, he was placed in a level 3 yard. This meant he was grouped with men who were assessed at a level 3 for danger of violence on a custody risk scale of 1 low to 4 high. He said he was terrified most of the time. During his first months in prison, a riot broke out on his yard in the form of a gang fight. In these situations, all inmates must take a side or be attacked in a fight, or in the future by retaliation for not taking a side. He lay down and hit his face on the yard. He said the guards made fun of him and told him to man up and fight, but he stayed down. The action got him transferred to a safer placement, which meant segregation into a, quote, sensitive needs yard, where the lowest and most vulnerable prisoners, the child molesters, sex offenders, and snitches, were housed because they needed protection from more mainline inmates who do not tolerate them. Even in prisons where inmates have little social hierarchy still exists. The inmate I was talking to blamed the state-appointed lawyer for not presenting his parole case more effectively. He had a job waiting, a supportive family, and a crime-free, if not promising, life ahead, he said. But he also knew that his crime, being infamous, would be hard to overcome. He said that his story had been made into a movie with a famous star playing his role. I unconsciously counseled him in his situation, and he later said he appreciated my role as, quote, principal Bill, with the young man, prepping his thoughts for the parole hearing. I remember saying, this is all bad, but you have to be good. Just like I would have to an errant sixth-grade boy at my school. I asked him about surfing. He said as a teenager, he had a shortboard and thrashed waves. He said when he gets out, he will get a longboard and just ride waves. And he asked him what he would tell the parole board next time he got a chance. He held out his hands, palms down, and said he would tell them he will work his job, paddle out into the surf every day, and praise the water. I understood the solace he was seeking from a relationship with pristine nature. I wondered to myself for a moment if some connection to nature could be restorative, therapeutically represented in a vocational course in prison. Is vocational coastal cleanup possible? Absurd. Andy indicated to him that some on the parole board might not understand what he was saying, so he might want to think about how he states his meaning. He told us about his own father, who was also a professor like us.
And let me remind listeners that my two guests are retired professor Bill Rich, who is reading a vignette from their book, and also professor of sociology Tony Waters is also here as a co-author of this book. So Bill is reading this story of a visit to a prison when he sees this young man who makes him think, this kid looks like my own son. So then you got home.
When I got home, I told this story to a friend who's a social work administrator. He laughed at me and joked that I might have overly identified with this interview subject. And such was the case, obviously. But it served also as an experience that brought all the issues of incarceration and prison life home to me as a, quote, white professor guy who lives in a life far from prison. These inmates were not my children or like me or mine in thousands of ways. Few spoke of fathers. But when I encountered one who could have been like my family, I was affected deeply. I gained an awful understanding of the deep, debilitating effects of prison as punishment. I was even more horrified now at the routine dehumanization of seeing black or brown men locked in individual cages, waiting for transport, and walking in shackles from wrists to waist to ankles. The unthinkable that such a fate could befall one's own child would be nearly unbearable. The point of prison is to punish and chastise the individual for the sake of justice. The loss spouses, children, and parents of inmates must feel daily extends the pain and chastisement across generations. I read in the newspaper that the inmate we spoke to was recently paroled against the recommendation of the governor and the pleas of the mother of the murdered boy. Newspaper reports said he was a model prisoner, earned an associate's degree while incarcerated, a privilege extended to prisoners who have the family to pay for books and tuition. Seeing the brown and black inmates now as I see this paroled individual, I hope they can overcome the damage prison inflicts. I wonder what kind of support paroled inmates really need to avoid recidivating. I also wonder how we can resolve the paradox of rehabilitation with punishment and the impact of punishment on victims' families and our society.
This is retired Professor Bill Rich, and he's reading from a book, Prison Vocational Education and Policy in the United States, A Critical Perspective on Evidence-Based Reform. And he is here with Professor Tony Waters, a co-author of this book. And people must be wondering, well, how did two nice guys like this end up in prison?
Well, I started it, I guess, right?
Time to come clean. Tony.
Okay. It was Andy Dick and I, Andy Dick being our co-author who has passed away in 2012, very tragically. We are both professors at the Department of Sociology here at Chico State with an interest in criminology. And we had worked together earlier on an evaluation of a parenting program that the California Department of Corrections was actually the California Youth Authority at the time, was evaluating and moved in when there was another chance 4 or 5 years later to apply for money to study prison vocational education. And so we started to apply for that, and they said, well, you guys are sociologists, and we're really evaluating is prison vocational education. You really need a curriculum specialist on this. And so we started saying, oh, what's a curriculum specialist? So I talked to a colleague who was chair of the Department of Education, and she recommended I talk to Bill Rich,
who was in the department at that time.
Department of Education. I actually knew him at the time. I said, of course.
He's a curriculum specialist.
That's what a curriculum specialist is. I thought he was an administration expert. So I went and talked to Bill, and then we tell the story of that first conversation a bit in the book, talking about how this would be an outstanding opportunity to have an unusual access to a prison. Bill was interested in doing something that was outside his own experience in K-12 education, which he has extensive experience, but still involves education. Andy and I were interested in having this access to prison, and this seemed to be the way to go, and Andy took the lead with the project, negotiated with the California Department of Corrections, the Office of Research, to get the right kind of combination of things that they wanted and that we wanted to do.
Well, could I interrupt just a second?
Sure.
Because that meeting I found was quite revealing. When Andy goes in, this is May of 2008, and he has this meeting with, and who are the different entities represented at this meeting that Andy attended?
Well, I think Bill was one of the people there. I was actually in Germany at that time. So I'll let Bill tell the story. He was there.
Okay, well, so Andy and Bill, that's right. Okay. Andy and Bill are at this meeting. Mm-hmm. And who else was there?
Well, there was the senior staff of the Correctional Education Department. And then there was a panel of people from IT, that is some sort of systems data collection. There was
Well, you say the Office of Correctional Education, OCE.
That's part of staff. California Department of Corrections. Yeah. They have their own Department of Education.
Yeah. And then there were some people, we really didn't know who they were, but they were obviously important and they were going to be part of this decision. They were present. They were all connected with OCE, Office of Correctional Education, in some way. I think there were some grant writer people or other funding people and program specialists. So we got into this meeting, and
You refer to him as a research manager who just gave Andy a hard time. He blasted Andy. And you say Andy gave as well as he took.
That's right.
And then when this guy left the room, I guess he had to go to another meeting, people came up and said, "Well, Andy, here's the way it really is."
That's exactly right. And this was the first – so they all, actually everybody congratulated Andy. I mean, lots of handshakes all around. You guys did really well. The blasting was about the application. They wanted a really short turnaround. And he said, "Well, I'll do this much, but you know, you're not being realistic." And so that made them angry. And after the blasting took place and the person left, then everyone was happy to have us be on the project. But it was kind of symbolic for the way prison life is. You know, what you see is not what you get. There's always another layer.
That's what's so interesting about your book.
Yeah.
My goodness, we just don't know what's going on behind the scenes.
We still don't, do we?
No, not really.
Yeah. Did that guy really exist?
Yeah. Well, the research manager, this is part of the shifting sands, which you're going to read about. There's so much churn. And, of course, in the middle of the crash, the financial crash, there was more churn.
It's even exacerbated.
So we had numerous research managers. And so part of Andy's great success was to keep this project floating through the various managers.
We had five or six, didn't we?
Yeah, to keep them committed.
During the 3 years.
Yeah, you'd be given some instructions, information, and the next thing you know, there would be a turnover and you were answering to somebody else and somebody you didn't know what had gone before. And that's why you refer to it as shifting sands.
Right. And it was in the context of the 2008 crash and the subsequent
budget
crisis of California.
Yeah. There was a real scramble at the state level in all departments. I think people were getting laid off and moved around. So
yeah, you mentioned that the compromises that had to be made and these competing demands like the state budget crisis, rapid changes in the economy as a result of this Great Recession of 2008 to 2010, and then declining budgets in research and education. And as you were just mentioning, this rapid turnover in staff, personnel, and prisoners. Mm-hmm. And so here you're trying to grab this structure that's on shifting sand.
Right.
To do your job that you were asked to do.
Right.
And this is what you're up against. We want to hear more about this, of what the challenges that are presented in the course of this project that the two of you, actually the three of you, were working on. My guests are retired Professor Bill Rich and current Professor of Sociology, Tony Waters, and we're talking about their book, Prison Vocational Education and Policy in the United States. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll hear more about what Andy's experiences were in a prison. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm here with Professors Bill Rich and Tony Waters, who were asked to evaluate vocational education in California prisons, and they drafted a proposal in 2007, and the final report was issued in 2011. So welcome back, Professors.
Thank you very much.
And Tony, you were just telling us about how this project got off the ground to begin with.
Right.
And I would like for you to read, you have vignettes in your book, and one of the stories involved your co-author,
right.
the
Andy
third
Dick,
author of this book, Andy Dick, and one of his visits to a prison. Would you read that story? It's called Sunglasses.
Right. Okay, we were brought to the prison by our guide, a former vocational education instructor who had been promoted to be a system-wide vice principal at the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation headquarters in Sacramento. On the drive down, it became apparent that he despised inmates and saw them as always conniving, plotting to cheat, overpowering, or committing some act of manipulation or violence. He mouthed the words of rehabilitation, but also expressed his resentment of correctional officers, describing them as lifer employees, assigned to work with prisoners he considered simply as sociopaths. As an expression of his distrust in prisoners, our guide and more than a few teachers and educational administrators in the system repeated the joke. How do you know when an inmate is lying? When he opens his mouth.
And that, too, is you feel sorry for both this guy and the inmates when he despises these people he's working with.
Yeah, the inmates despise him, too. Yeah,
exactly. So it's mutual, and here this guy goes to work, but you make the point in your book, there's a reason. There's one reason these guys show up at work, and that is to retire.
To retire, right.
It's a
culture of retirement.
Yeah. So that's the reason this guy shows up. He hates the inmates. They hate him, but yet he gets to work because one day he's going to get to retire.
That was a very common sentiment we heard. Having said that, we also appreciated very much the
exceptions to
the exceptions, and even the ones who wrestled with it and were looking at that retirement date that was, you know, 5, 10, 20 years out, but also wanted to do the very best in a very, very difficult situation in a huge bureaucracy that just was tough on not only inmates but also the employees.
And that's one of the things we come to appreciate when we read your book, that very fact you were just saying.
Okay, thank you.
Because a lot of us laymen have no idea what it's like.
Let me chime in on this.
This is Professor Bill Rich.
On this topic as well. I think as Tony continues reading, you'll see that this perspective, when we described them, was also kind of naive on our part. So you'll see that we had a kind of naive stance in judging the CDCR employees when we first started, compared to the reality that we learned about. So there are reasons why the employees became bitter. It's not a character flaw necessarily in the employees. There, as you'll see, as the story continues, simply believing that you're going to go in there and spread light and wisdom among these guys.
It's very naive.
Yeah, it's very naive. Of course, we believe that it can be done, but the cost on the people who are working with them is great as well.
Oh, yeah. When you're reading this, you can understand why somebody would become embittered and just want to give up.
Yeah.
And many of them don't give up. That's the amazing thing.
Yeah. And we as readers admire right. those who do.
Stick with it. Some of the teachers who are working, you know, 20 or 30 years in these positions. Bill met some, what he noticed were outstanding teachers there.
I love to talk about great teaching. And you know, I spent a lifetime hanging around schools. I love schools and teachers and watching them work. And I'll say this. Often great teachers don't have a way to easily explain the theories under which they're operating. They just know how to be successful with their students. And I saw that time after time after time in one very high security place. Andy and I were interviewing a teacher, and I asked him to explain the steps of his process. And he, you know, sort of blithely went through. And it was a great pre-diagnosis assessment, step-by-step instruction followed by more assessment, and then a way to relate to these students. Well, when we looked up at the office, there was, of course, guards, correctional officers out in the classroom, and there were two inmates there with signs up that said, "Hurry up, we need your help," to the teacher. So, you know, they were looking to us for help. They were looking to that teacher. And so he was one of many who grabbed us as a highly successful,
impressed,
committed person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So Tony is reading a vignette from their book. Professor Tony Waters, he is a professor of sociology currently at Chico State University, and a co-author of theirs, there are three authors of this book, is describing a visit to a prison.
Mm-hmm. When we first arrived at the prison, we were met outside as guests, objects of both suspicion and official respect. The site vice principal took us to the classes we were to observe in a modern shop building. He was a person who helped us to understand that what we confidentially termed the retirement culture of CDCR. This vice principal exemplified what appeared to be the main raison d'etre for many employees in corrections waiting for retirement. Given the opportunity, such individuals always talked about what they would do upon retiring at age 50, while pointing to the legend that the life expectancy for CDCR employees is only about 56.
That was shocking, Tony. And I might remind people what those initials stand for, CDCR. Or
California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation.
California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And the life expectancy for these employees was only age 56?
That's what they believe. We couldn't verify it.
Oh,
but,
okay.
But that's what they believe. That's the urban legend going around CDCR.
Well, among the folks we talked
to. This is Professor Bill Rich, by the way.
Among the folks we talked to who focused on their retirement, we would hear this kind of a story. We never checked that as a fact, so we don't really know. But I think that.
But
I
that's
think,
what they.
That was that's
the,
what they
the
believe.
Perspective
they
of some of those folks. Yeah.
A number of us told us this, and I tried to Google it on the internet, which is a source of all wisdom, and I couldn't find it as being verified. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that people did believe that. You know, that we're in this high stress environment. We're looking at strokes and heart disease and cancer. We have this short 6 years out in front of us.
Window for there to enjoy retirement.
To enjoy retirement before that heart attack. And it's a tragic way to look at life. And
isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Mm. And it's something we heard over and over again. Again, not being able to verify it, but we did hear it.
Mm-hmm.
The shops we were to observe were large and contained functional, if not up-to-date, equipment. Inmates entered the shop through the double-wide slide-up doors that clattered open to receive them from their cells at the appointed time after a complete strip search. The building was rectangular with two complete shops. A shared classroom stood at the center of the building with access from both shops. Likewise, the teacher's office was at the center of the building with door access into each of the shops. Looking at the teacher's office from the shop floor, one saw a low counter that formed a kind of enclosed area around the door. This area contained desks for porters and other assistants. The job title porter reminded me of the black railroad servants on the Pullman cars. One might assume the position would have a title such as shop assistant or aide, but porter was an institutional job, and these inmates were selected and evaluated by custody officials. Porters were assigned to any prison function, from education to laundry. Teachers made requests for specific inmates to serve as the porters due to their knowledge and skills, but the selection criteria were ultimately left up to custody officials. We entered, were met by the teacher, introduced, and led from the shop floor into the shared classroom. The teacher gave us a brief talk about the facility, the inmate students, the porter, tool security, and the program. We expressed our gratitude for the opportunity to observe and interact in the shop and classroom with the inmate students. I wandered from one workstation to another, observed the equipment, and sought an opportunity to interact. The inmate students were a mixed group of Hispanics and African Americans. This integration was an achievement in itself. I introduced myself to a small group of inmate students as a professor and researcher. This alien identity created an opening for conversation. I watched as each inmate thought about talking to me. Typically, he would pause to consider the pros and cons of speaking with an outsider. Eyes would move right and left as he considered the alternatives. But since we were so foreign in the universe of the prison, we were neither guard, teacher, counselor, nor medical person. We seemed to pose no threat. When I asked questions, I first received short answers. What are you learning in this class? I'm learning about saw blades. When one student, an African-American man I estimated to be in his late 30s, asked me if I would like to see the plans for his house, I eagerly said I was very interested. He explained he would build this house when he was released. He would not only construct a small-scale model because there was no lumber resources to speak of in the program, and he produced a thick binder from a drawer and opened it for me. He explained each of the well-developed sketches. These were his plans for the life he dreamed of. There was a family room, the kitchen, the living room, the backyard patio with barbecue, the lawn, and the study. He needed a study because he wanted to continue reading and learning. His intensity was impressive. I did not need to prompt him to tell me more. If I pointed to any area of the plans, he spoke of the alternative ideas he had considered and why he had decided to build the design we saw in his plans. This was an interesting individual, bright and engrossed in his ideas. We were completely engaged in this project that he planned to begin in less than 2 years after he completed his sentence. I was so intently involved in this inmate's explanation of his dreams and actual plans that I did not at first respond to our guide, who lightly touched at my elbow. I remember thinking it would be rude to disengage from this man's story, so I simply ignored the guide. Hearing these dreams coupled with skills learned in vocational education courses made this a compelling experience for me.
I'm here for just a second. This is Professor Tony Waters reading from a book about prison vocational education. And what you're getting to, too, is borders on this naivete that you were talking about before, because he's saying, oh, this guy's got such a, so interesting to say. I'm going to listen to him. And the guide's trying to elbow him, say, nudge. There's some other things you need to be aware of. And he says, no, don't bother me, so to speak. And again, this is naivete that you've got to keep your eyes and ears open if you're in a prison.
Right.
You know, when you're a professor.
This is Professor Bill Rich.
When you're a professor, you think you're in charge of something.
Oh, yes, I've encountered that.
And I think this was part of the moment. You know, I'm in charge of this moment. You know, leave me alone. This is my. You know, you get that feeling.
And doesn't realize how important it is to listen to somebody who knows the ropes.
Yeah, the context,
so to speak.
Context counts, as we say.
Yeah, and if you'd continue,
okay,
Professor.
Okay, we're going to get you the context here. I was so intently involved in the inmate's explanation of his dreams and actual plans that I did not first respond to our guide, who lightly touched my elbow. Our guide next stood beside me to intervene, and I raised my hand as a gesture of impatience at being interrupted. So often we were shuttled from place to place due to the insecurity needs of the institution, and here was finally an opportunity for me to hear an inmate tell a significant story. After all, our guide had told us on our eight-hour drive, the many ways educators resented and even scorned correctional officers for their self-congratulatory, pompous attitudes. If a guard, for instance, found a shiv, which is like a knife, he would be celebrated with a medal and given a commendation for saving lives. This would serve as one more piece of evidence in the propaganda machine that only guards with their bulletproof vests, batons, mace, radios, helmets, combat boots, green uniforms, and guns save us from the bloodthirsty hordes of vicious inmates. On the other hand, teachers enter, work, and leave the prison in casual street clothes without radios, batons, vests, or other accoutrements of power and violence. Many of these teachers have negotiated weapons away from inmates, including shivs, and stored them in their desk drawers until a CO could be called to collect them. These teachers build trust, respect, and reinforce the vision of the classroom as a sanctuary with no congratulation.
Now, let me ask here that the teachers do not have vests, but my understanding is that you did. You got stab-proof vests when you went in?
No.
We did in one
oh, maybe
institution.
It was the one. Okay.
Only one institution, and we were talking about that. It seemed to be a little bit of theater. And
oh, okay, because I remembered that, but that was not typical. Yeah. That was atypical.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, the only thing the clothing specifications were it couldn't be blue.
I know. I hadn't thought of that. They told you don't wear blue.
Gray, or green like the correctional officers.
Yeah.
Because if everybody else falls to the ground and you're standing there in blue, you just might get shot.
You're a legitimate target.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, Tony, if you'd go ahead and continue.
Our guide pressed my upper arm again and said, look up. I said, just a second, and remained focused on the inmate and his story, a bit annoyed at the intrusion. The inmate looked around and sighed disappointedly. Oh, no. The guide motioned the inmate away from me and again more urgently. Look around. You need to move with me now. I saw that the workstations were empty. Look at the shop, he said. I thought the inmates had started to clean up and slowly took in the whole room. I didn't know exactly what I was looking at. As we moved deliberately toward the teacher's desk, he said, look on the corners. They've ganged up. There was no cleanup going on. Inmate students had huddled in the corners of the shop. Norteños, Sereños, Bloods, Crips each had their own corners. See how they are organized, our guide said. The point man, or first fighter, stood in the farthest out into the shop while others were arranged in a defensive positions behind them. Each chief or shot caller was in the corner, sitting in a chair accompanied by two others. This form was constant for each group. All eyes were up and watching the room. I scanned the room to find the student with whom I had been talking. He looked at me and mouthed the words, sorry. He shrugged and moved into the middle position in his corner holding his binder. The room was quiet. What's going on? I whispered to our guide. He drew me farther away from the shop and into the adjoining classroom. I learned that my colleague, Andy, was talking to a couple of inmate students when he got a phone call on the teacher's office phone. He went to answer the phone, but forgot that he had left his sunglasses on the table in the classroom. When he returned from the call, Andy remembered his sunglasses, but saw that they were gone. He told the teacher, who immediately relayed the information to the school's vice principal and our guide. Next, the classroom correctional officer was told. Everything changed at this point. Andy's glasses were like finding $1 million. They could be sold as is in the yard. In the right hands, something as mundane as sunglasses could be made into weapons, wire to stab and glass to slash or cut. Inmates showed fear not of us, but of the rival gangs in the different corners. In a moment, the entire dynamic in that shop had changed from learning and thinking to one of fear.
This is Professor Tony Waters reading from a book that he is co-author of, Prison Vocational Education and Policy in the United States. And what is being described is a visit to a prison, and one of the professors has forgotten his he left his sunglasses on the table, he went out to take a phone call, he comes back, the sunglasses aren't there, and most of us would think, oh, well, they'll turn up there somewhere, and we wouldn't give it much thought. But this is a big deal. And so go on to tell us why this is a big deal, Tony.
Our presence changed the way a situation like this is normally handled. The vice principal stepped in and took charge, leaving the teacher to observe passively. The vice principal was embarrassed at such a poor showing of inmate vocational education. He yelled at the class, he cursed, and told the inmate students they were a worthless bunch of idiots and knuckleheads. Well, that's not what he actually said.
It was worse than that.
But this is for radio.
Okay. So for radio, he called them knuckleheads.
Yeah.
And idiots.
He told somewhere in the shop, he told them the glasses needed to be produced within 5 minutes and placed somewhere in the shop, no questions asked. If the glasses appeared, the whole incident would be forgotten. If the glasses did not appear, he would call in the bulls, which meant the correctional officers. And they knew what that meant. The inmate students remained silent and unresponsive to the anger and threats of the vice principal. As researchers, we watched and anxiously waited. The strategy, the threat, did not work. As was later speculated, the glasses may have been passed to another shop in the seconds Andy's was in the office talking on the phone, and from there to the cells and yards. It was likely that no one in the classroom possessed the glasses at the time the inmate students were given the ultimatum. A squad of 8 or 10 bulls arrived in the classroom. The VP, vice principal, repeated the conditions that the glasses must be produced. While we observed what was happening, the classroom teacher confided to me that he would have handled the situation differently. He said he would have told them he was embarrassed, that he trusted them, and they were violating his trust. He would have appealed to their desire to maintain their own classroom standards. He expected he would have learned the story and might have been able to retrieve the glasses and somehow from a location in his own shop or in the one that adjoined the shared classroom. But the fact that the bosses were embarrassed and had called the bulls made it too late.
So here's this guy ranting and cursing, and the sunglasses are, it's unlikely they're even in the room. He said, okay, put those sunglasses back, and they're probably long gone.
And only one or two of the guys know where they are anyway. You know, it's the other 26 are getting yelled at, and they're...
And they're afraid that...
This is Professor Bill Rich.
The other guys in the class are afraid that something is going to happen. And so where normally the classroom is the sanctuary, is a place where you get respect from the teacher. They call you Mr. You're there because you want to learn. And suddenly when that situation changes and there's a threat, they go back to their place of safety, which is with their gang in their corner.
In that context, yeah. And they don't necessarily all like their gang. It's just that this is the social world they live in. Yeah.
They don't have a choice. Yeah.
Really. They don't have a choice, or they believe have a choice. The place is organized around gangs.
Yeah. This is sociology professor Tony Waters reading from this book about prison vocational education. So at this point, they're being ranted at, and there's really not much that, if anything, they can do about it. And the teacher's saying, you know, don't think he handled this very well.
Yeah.
And then Franz Kafka.
Franz Kafka pops up. He became something of a theme in our whole research project. So Franz Kafka himself could not have written a more surreal account of an educational experience for both inmates and researchers. The threats to produce an object no one possessed, the naive interest of a professor researcher in the authentic and heartfelt project of an inmate student, the passivity and power of inmates under the threat and the feckless attempt to control the situation by the administrator. Onto this stage sauntered a troop of bulls ready to gaze up the anus and into all the other orifices of each inmate student during a strip search to ensure the missing glasses or their deconstructed parts were not spirited away in the shop in a body cavity. All this while everyone knew the parts were most likely long gone. We were escorted out to our golf courts by the cursing VP, vice principal, who let loose with epithets that reflected both his frustration and his commitment to the retirement culture that permeated the conversation of so many CDCR employees. All he wanted was his pension. It was his only reason for putting up with the duplicity of prisoners and bulls alike. And so we return to the question of why we wrote this book. Our introductory story is replete with metaphors for the entire problem of education and specifically vocational education in prison. We left the prisons after each research visit thinking how good it was to be leaving. The dust we shook from our clothing is often the fine alkali powder of lower Central Valley of California that covers everything from furniture to floors in such overcrowded, hot, and disheartening places. But the classrooms are still a sanctuary. The teachers are, for the most part, natural people, developers, psychologists, and managers who offer respect, understanding, know-how, skills, and knowledge. Within the life world of a school in prison or a prison surrounding a school, teachers transport their students into a world of hope for a more normal life of self-respect, work, productive relationships, and accomplishment. The fear experienced by inmate students rarely entered the classrooms, but when it managed to seep in it, as related in this story of the missing sunglasses, it engulfed everyone, students, teachers, researchers, administrators, custody officials, and set in motion the dull and ineffective bureaucratic response using the threats and fears of B.F. Skinner. There he is again. B.F. Skinner's experiments of incentives and punishments. The consequences, passive resistance, strip searches, movement back into cells, and class cancellation followed by investigation. All ranks were closed around chief identities, custody and prison staff versus inmates and gangs. We wondered how these teachers could perform under such strange and unpredictable working conditions. Most were hopeful in the belief that their work created opportunity both inside and outside the prison for each student who was able to grasp the reality. Small victories carried them, such as procuring a few sticks of lumber from another department in the prison. The gallows humor and disdain for inmates is a defense mechanism that permits teachers to endure the myriad of disappointments they faced. Likewise, we wondered how inmate students could learn under such circumstances. We found hope and achievement amid an environment where many disincentives and norms flourished to work against both hope and learning alike. Andy's sunglasses were never found.
This is Professor Tony Waters reading from Prison Vocational Education and Policy in the United States, A Critical Perspective on Evidence-Based Reform. He has just been reading one of the vignettes from their book. There are three authors, Andrew Dick, and he was the one whose sunglasses were missing in this last story, Bill Rich, a retired professor of education from Chico State University, and Professor Tony Waters, a professor of sociology at Chico State. So they hire you guys to take on this project, and you work on it. And there are a lot of funny places in your book. It surprised me. I would be laughing at a book on prison reform. But one of them was when you write up your report and they say, we want it short. Be brief, guys. We don't want to read a lot of it. And so how many pages did they expect you to give them?
60.
60 pages. Okay, guys, we want 60 pages and we are going to read 60 pages. And what did you turn into them?
296.
296 pages, single space pages, and they say, hey, wait a minute, this is not going to work. And so they give it back to you, and then what did you do? And this is what, I mean, that part made me laugh, but then I laughed even harder when I saw what you guys did.
Well, we turned it down to 60 pages, and we gave them a 200-page appendix. And then we posted the original up to the internet where CTCR employees are now reading it. It's on my academia.edu account if anybody's interested. So, and we turned it into this book. That's the main thing we did.
So you put this the results of your research in this book, and we've posted it online. But now did these administrators say, okay, we want 60 pages, and did they read it?
Nah.
So the contract called for 60 pages. And maybe flesh out this discussion a little bit.
This is Professor Bill Rich.
One of the things we did when Andy was here, we really committed, the three of us, to take on this project seriously, not just for an experience. And that we thought, well, what we're going to do is we're going to tell the truth. And when we originally met, when Andy and Tony and I originally met.
Now, that seems obvious to us, who's saying, well, of course he's going to tell the truth. But,
you know.
The fact that you mentioned it makes me think, okay, researchers don't always tell the truth.
Well, this is actually the point of this book. The book is not titled How to Fix a Prison or What to Do to Make Prisons Better. The book is about evidence-based research and the tension.
Because that's what you're hired to do. Yeah. They want numbers.
Yeah, but there's a great tension between the existing structures in the organization, the new structures that the reform is trying to create, how one co-opts the other, the political tensions for immediate success. So you're not really independent because there's always this pressure to, instead of be totally objective, but to help us show that we're doing well. And so that's one of the pieces we live with. That's kind of, instead of just publishing the report as a book, we want to discuss this piece of the idea.
It's evidence-based reform. Anytime you have sponsored research where you're getting a pile of money from somebody else who wants you to research them.
And this was a good bit of, you might mention how this money was made available.
It was made available. There was, California had a major prison reform in 2007 from, it's called AB 2900.
Assembly Bill
900. Promoted by the legislature and Governor Schwarzenegger at the time. They said, we really want to do rehabilitation. Bill and I, Andy, we're all very sympathetic to this goal. Said, but when we do it, we want to have confirmation that we're actually doing what we said we're going to do. And in a world of policymaking, they don't want to say, well, no, you really have wasted the money. And we're not giving you this pot of money to do the research to say that we're not doing our job. And this is inherent to almost any type of policy-based research where it's just sponsored, which is not a popular thing to say. Because you're not going to get another contract.
If I hire you to prove that aspirin works and you say aspirin doesn't work, then I don't want to hear that.
Basically, yeah. And there's a lot of that kind of research going on. Mm-hmm. It's inherent. We still think that looking for evidence is better than not looking for evidence. We talk about some of the ways that people operate from the gut, which we do not think is looking for a good way to administer a prison. We'd much rather they hire people like us to do this. But the public and the prisons need to recognize that when we do this kind of research and they put these demands on us, there is a conflict of interest.
So what I'm going to do before we say goodbye is ask you to repeat your website, because people, this is Professor Tony Waters, in case people want to learn more about your research.
Okay. Well, it's a standard academia. It's called www.academia.edu. Then you put in my name, Tony Waters, and you will find a copy of the original report. There are a couple extracts from the book as well, of the typescript, because we cannot put in, for copyright reasons, the actual book.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to both of you. My guests have been Professor Bill Rich and Professor Tony Waters, who have written the book, Prison Vocational Education Policy in the United States. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.